Okay, so the next sutta is Saṅyutta 35, sutta number 95, and Malankyaputta is who we've come across before, is being requesting a teaching and getting a bad time from the Buddha, and then giving a teaching. Then the Venerable Malankyaputta approached the Blessed One and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that, having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Hear now, Malankyaputta, what should I say to the young bhikkhus when a bhikkhu like you, old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, ask me for an exhortation in brief? Although, Venerable Sir, I am old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, let the Blessed One teach me the Dhamma in brief. Let the Fortunate One teach me the Dhamma in brief. Perhaps I may understand the meaning of the Blessed One's statement. Perhaps I may become an heir to the Blessed One's statement." What do you think, Malankyaputta? Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for those forms cognizable by the eye that you have not seen and never saw before, that you do not see and would not think might be seen? No, Venerable Sir. Do you have any desire, lust, or affection for those sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, taste cognizable by the tongue, tactile objects cognizable by the body, for those mental phenomena cognizable by the mind that you have not cognized and never cognized before, that you do not cognize and would not think might be cognized? No, Venerable Sir. Hear, Malankyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you. In the seen, there will be merely the seen. In the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. In the cognized, there will be merely the cognized. When, Malankyaputta, regarding things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized by you, in the seen, there will be merely the seen. In the heard, there will be merely the heard. In the sensed, there will be merely the sensed. In the cognized, there will be merely the cognized. Then, Malankyaputta, you will not be by that. That's sort of quote-unquote, you will not be, quote-unquote, by that. When, Malankyaputta, you are not by that, then you will not be, quote-unquote, therein. When, Malankyaputta, you are not therein, then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. This itself is the end of suffering. I understand in detail, Venerable Sir, the meaning of what was stated by the Blessed One in brief. And then this is all in verse. Having seen a form with mindfulness muddled, attending to the pleasing sign, one experiences it with infatuated mind and remains tightly holding to it. Many feelings flourish within, originating from the visible form, covetousness and annoyance as well, by which one's mind becomes disturbed. For one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. Having heard a sound with mindfulness muddled, having smelt an odor with mindfulness muddled, having enjoyed a taste with mindfulness muddled, having felt a contact with mindfulness muddled, having known an object with mindfulness muddled, for one who accumulates suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be far away. When, firmly mindful, one sees a form, one is not inflamed by lust for forms. One experiences it with dispassionate mind, and one does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one sees the form, and while one undergoes a feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. When firmly mindful, one hears a sound, one is not inflamed by lust for sounds. When firmly mindful, one smells an odor, one is not inflamed by lust for odors. When firmly mindful, one enjoys a taste, one is not inflamed by lust for tastes. When firmly mindful, one feels a contact, one is not inflamed by lust for contacts. One experiences it with dispassionate mind and does not remain holding it tightly. One fares mindfully in such a way that even as one feels a contact, while one undergoes that feeling, suffering is exhausted, not built up. For one dismantling suffering thus, Nibbana is said to be close by. It is in such a way, Venerable Sir, that I understand in detail the meaning of what was stated by the Blessed One in brief. Good, Malankyaputta. It is good that you understand in detail the meaning of what was stated by me in brief. And the Buddha repeats the whole thing. It is in such a way, Malankyaputta, that the meaning of what was stated by me in brief should be understood in detail. Then the Venerable Malankyaputta, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and, after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, the Venerable Malankyaputta, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, in this very life, entered and dwelt in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the household life into homelessness. He directly knew, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this state of being. And the Venerable Malankyaputta became one of the arahants. So that, of course, that is a reiteration of the teachings from the Udana, the Bahudacharya, Bahudaricharya, and a very famous discourse. But a good one to be remembering, particularly in context with the sense bases. Any questions? Okay. Continue on. Sangyutta 35. Sutta number 96. What is decline? Bhikkhus, I will teach you about one who is subject to decline, about one who is not subject to decline, and about the six mastered bases. Listen to that. And how, bhikkhus, is one subject to decline? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has seen a form, just the decline is parihana dhamma. Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has seen a form with the eye, there arise in him evil, unwholesome states, memories, and intentions connected with the fetters. If the bhikkhu tolerates them and does not abandon them, dispel them, put an end to them, and obliterate them, he should understand this thus: I am declining away from wholesome states. For this has been called decline by the Blessed One. Further, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has heard a sound with the ear, smelt an odor with the tongue, smelt an odor with the nose, tasted an object with the tongue, experienced a tangible with the body, cognized the mental phenomena with the mind, there arise in him evil, unwholesome states, memories, and intentions connected with fetters. If the bhikkhu tolerates them and does not abandon them, dispel them, put an end to them, and obliterate them, he should understand this thus: I am declining away from wholesome states. For this has been called decline by the Blessed One. It is in such a way, bhikkhus, that one is subject to decline. And how, bhikkhus, is one not subject to decline? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has seen a form with the eye, there arise in him evil, unwholesome states, memories, and intentions connected with the fetters. If the bhikkhu does not tolerate them, but abandons them, dispels them, puts an end to them, and obliterates them, he should understand this thus: I am not declining away from wholesome states, for this has been called non-decline by the Blessed One. Further, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has heard a sound with the ear, so on through the senses, cognized the mental phenomena with the mind, there arise in him evil, unwholesome states, memories, and intentions connected with the fetters. If the bhikkhu does not tolerate them, but abandons them, dispels them, puts an end to them, and obliterates them, he should understand this thus: I am not declining away from wholesome states, for this has been called non-decline by the Blessed One. It is in such a way, bhikkhus, that one is not subject to decline. And what, bhikkhus, are the six mastered bases? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has seen a form with the eye, there do not arise in him evil, unwholesome states, nor any memories and intentions connected with the fetters. The bhikkhu should understand this thus: this base has been mastered, for this has been called a mastered base by the Blessed One. Further, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu has heard a sound with the ear, so on through the senses, cognized the mental phenomena with the mind, there do not arise in him evil, unwholesome states, nor any memories and intentions connected with the fetters. The bhikkhu should understand this thus: this base has been mastered, for this has been called a mastered base by the Blessed One. These, bhikkhus, are called the six mastered bases. Any questions? Yeah.
I presume the arising of evil, unwholesome states, and memories and intentions are due to the fetters. That kind of an expansion of just the term.
Yes. As I think that in general, the in this sense, I think the word fetter is really lining up more with the as I'd read in that sutta on the black and white oxen, that it's around the nature of desire and craving. Yeah, connecting the base with its object. Yeah.
So then the mastered bases would then be the sense base operating without any craving and clinging would imply arahantship. Yeah?
It would imply arahantship. Yeah. That's mastered, all right. Yeah, and there's no. I think it's also, you know, it's good to there's. For it to be mastered, then it isn't something that one is holding in place through effort.
Not
subject to decline. So it's not having to be held in place by kind of effort and force, which is that's hopeful. Okay, the next sutta is about the end of the world. And Ananda's comprehension of it. This is Samyutta 35, Sutta number 116. Bhikkhus, I say that the end of the world cannot be known, seen, or reached by traveling. Yet, bhikkhus, I also say that without reaching the end of the world, there is no making an end to suffering. Having said this, the Blessed One rose from his seat and entered his dwelling, which could be a bit frustrating. Sort of, all of a sudden it's like, what the heck? What was that? Whoops. Then, soon after the Blessed One had left, the bhikkhus considered, now, friends, the Blessed One has risen from his seat and entered his dwelling after reciting a synopsis in brief without expounding the meaning in detail. Now, who will expound in detail the meaning of the synopsis that the Blessed One recited in brief? Then they considered. The Venerable Ananda is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise brothers in the holy life. The Venerable Ananda is capable of expounding in detail the meaning of this synopsis recited in brief by the Blessed One without expounding the meaning in detail. Let us approach him and ask him the meaning of this. Then those bhikkhus approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him, after which they sat down to one side and told him what had taken place, adding, "Let the Venerable Ananda expound it to us." The Venerable Ananda replied, "Friends, it is as though a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would pass over the root and trunk of a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, thinking that heartwood should be sought among the branches and foliage. And so it is with you, Venerable Ones. When you are face to face with the teacher, you pass by the Blessed One, thinking that I should be asked about the meaning. For, friends, knowing, the Blessed One knows. Seeing, he sees. He has become vision. He has become knowledge. He has become the Dhamma. He has become the Holy One. He is the expounder, the proclaimer, the elucidator of meaning, the giver of the deathless, the Lord of the Dhamma, the Tathagata. That was the time when you should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. As he explained it to you, so you should have remembered it. Surely, friend Ananda, knowing the Blessed One knows, seeing he sees, he has become vision, the one, the Tathagata. That was the time when we should have asked the Blessed One the meaning. And as he explained it to us, so we should have remembered it. Yet the Venerable Ananda is praised by the teacher and esteemed by his wise brothers in the holy life. The Venerable Ananda is capable of expounding the detailed meaning of this synopsis recited in brief by the Blessed One without expounding the meaning in detail. Let the Venerable Ananda expound it without finding it troublesome. Then listen, friends, and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the bhikkhus replied. The Venerable Ananda said this. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and entered his dwelling after reciting a synopsis in brief without expounding the meaning in detail, that is, bhikkhus, I say that the end of the world cannot be known, seen, or reached by traveling. Yet, bhikkhus, I also say that without reaching the end of the world, there is no making an end of suffering. I understand the detailed meaning of this synopsis as follows. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, this is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. And what, friends, is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world? The eye is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind is that in which the mind is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, this is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and entered his dwelling after reciting a synopsis in brief without expounding the meaning in detail, that is, bhikkhus, I say that the end of the world cannot be known, seen, or reached by traveling. Yet, bhikkhus, I also say that without reaching the end of the world, there is no making an end of suffering. I understand the meaning of this synopsis in detail to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Yes, friends, those bhikkhus replied. And having risen from their seats, they went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down to one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, "Then, Venerable Sir, we approached the Venerable Ananda and asked him about the meaning. The Venerable Ananda expounded the meaning to us in these ways, with these terms, with these phrases. Ananda is wise, bhikkhus. Ananda has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that it has been explained by Ananda. Such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it. So that sense of the... both in terms of the perceiver of the world, as in sort of having contacted the world, then one perceives it, one recognizes it, recognizes it, processes the information from the world, but then also conceiver of the world in terms of the, because there's like a subjective and an objective reciprocation going on all the time, so that we're both perceiving through the senses as well as conceiving about them in the sense of and whether it's a true story or not, it's still a story, so that we're those conceptions proliferations the commentary, the meaning that we imply toward the world is generated. It's all generated through the senses, so that that sense of having to understand those bases of contact.
Is there another sutta in the Mahatmya where a layman thinks that the Buddha is the same thing, but going to the end of the world of traveling?
Is there a Rohitasa Sutta? The Rohitasa was he tried. He actually tried. He had that ability, that psychic power, to sort of be able to travel great distances.
The note that the devotee had on that one was kind of, that's the most profound teaching of the Buddhist philosophy, is that last statement.
Well, I mean, it is in that sense of when you think in terms of the, again, just the authority for religious and spiritual understanding is not posited in externally, it's turning around and one recognizing that one has to take responsibility for that, the perceiving and the conceiving. But that in itself is enough for coming to an end of suffering and complete liberation. When the Buddha say, like, within this fathom-long body is the end of the world. Okay. So the next one is... Sutta 35, Sutta number 120, and this is Sutta concerning the foundations of the holy life. And on one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetis Grove, Anathapindika's park. Then a certain bhikkhu approached the Venerable Sariputta and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, a bhikkhu who was my co-resident has given up the training and returned to the lower life." That is, returned to the lay life. He is disrobed. "So it is, friend, when one does not guard the doors of the sense faculties, is immoderate in eating, and is not devoted to wakefulness. That a bhikkhu who does not guard the doors of the sense faculties, who is immoderate in eating, and who is not devoted to wakefulness, will maintain all his life the complete and pure holy life. This is impossible. But, friend, that a bhikkhu who guards the doors of the sense faculties, who is moderate in eating, and who is devoted to wakefulness, will maintain all his life the complete and pure holy life. This is possible. And how, friend, does one guard the doors of the sense faculties? Here, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu does not grasp its signs and features. Since, if he left the eye faculty unrestrained, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. Having heard sound with the ear, having smelt an odor with the nose, having savored a taste with the tongue, having felt a tactile object with the body, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, a bhikkhu does not grasp its signs and features. Since, if he left the mind faculty unrestrained, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. It is in this way, friend, that one guards the doors of the sense faculties. And how, friend, is one moderate in eating? Here, reflecting carefully, a bhikkhu takes food neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the support and maintenance of this body, for ending discomfort, and for assisting the holy life, considering, thus I shall terminate the old feeling and not arouse a new feeling, and I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. It is in this way, friend, that one is moderate in eating. And how, friend, is one devoted to wakefulness? Here, during the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, a bhikkhu purifies his mind of obstructive states. In the first watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, he purifies his mind of obstructive states. In the middle watch of the night, he lies down on his right side in the lion's posture, with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and clearly comprehending, after noting in his mind the idea of rising. After rising in the last watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, he purifies his mind of obstructive states. It is in this way, friend, that one is devoted to wakefulness. Therefore, friend, you should train yourself thus. We will guard the doors of the sense faculties. We will be moderate in eating. We will be devoted to wakefulness. Thus, friend, should you train yourself. And I've also got a note to read another sutta in connection with this, and that one is sutta number 239 in the same section. Bhikkhus, by possessing three qualities, a bhikkhu lives full of happiness and joy in this very life, and he has laid a foundation for the destruction of the taints. What are the three? He is one who guards the doors of the sense faculties, who is moderate in eating, and who is devoted to wakefulness. And how, bhikkhus, is one who guards the doors of the sense faculties? Okay, having seen the form with the eye, bhikkhu does not grasp its signs and features through the six sense doors. Since, if he left the mind faculty unrestrained, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and displeasure might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. Suppose, bhikkhus, a chariot harnessed to thoroughbreds was standing ready on even ground at a crossroads with a goad on hand. Then a skillful trainer, a charioteer of horses to be tamed, would mount it and, taking the reins in his left hand and the goad in his right, would drive away and return by any route he wants, whenever he wants. So too, a bhikkhu trains in protecting these six sense faculties, trains in controlling them, trains in taming them, trains in pacifying them, It is in this way, bhikkhus, that a bhikkhu guards the doors of the sense faculties. And how, bhikkhus, is a bhikkhu moderate in eating? Here, reflecting wisely, bhikkhu takes food neither for amusement nor intoxication, so on and so forth. Thus I shall terminate the old feeling and not arouse a new feeling, and I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. Just as a person anoints a wound only for the purpose of enabling it to heal, or just as one greases an axle only for the sake of transporting a load, so a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, takes food for assisting the holy life. It is in this way, bhikkhus, that a bhikkhu is moderate in eating. And how, bhikkhus, is a bhikkhu devoted to wakefulness? Here, during the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, a bhikkhu purifies his mind of obstructive states, and so on, first through the watches of the night. It is in this way, bhikkhus, that a bhikkhu is devoted to wakefulness. Bhikkhus, it is by possessing these three qualities that a bhikkhu lives full of happiness and joy in this very life, and he has laid the foundation for the destruction of the taints. So these fundamentals of the holy life, and keep it all kind of squelched down, but for because sometimes when we think of restraint, then it sort of feels of constraint, but the actual restraint is one that is basis for happiness and joy, and that sense of well-being, and blamelessness, but then also the inherently the kind of well-being that arises when we're able to relinquish the unwholesome states, and wholesome states are what are then left to arise, and continuity of wholesome states of consciousness, then one lives happily. Yeah.
This devotion to wakefulness, very well phrased there. What I noticed is that if I, late night practice, if I go later and later, what happens is I start sort of, unless I'm really careful, I start craving and wanting sleep. And then when I do go to sleep, it's really difficult to get up because it's been tanha pushing one towards sleep. I'm curious if you have any suggestions around just how to work with that. Being able to either work on setting that intention to wake up even after one is fairly tired from practice.
Well, I think one of the things in terms of especially at how one, I think, like sometimes if you're sitting, then the mind can get tired, and then if one goes to sleep because of that tiredness, just sort of conking out to sleep, then it's more difficult to get up. Whereas if one recognizes, and especially after one's been practicing for a while, one notices one's habits, the tendencies of the mind, the rhythms getting up and doing walking meditation, and then laying down to go to sleep after doing walking meditation, because we oftentimes have this kind of fixation of, I should be sitting, and it's like doing walking meditation or doing some yoga in the evening or some kind of activity that brightens the mind, and then one determines to go to sleep. In one sense, that intention, and then when one goes to sleep with an intent, clear intention, one tends to get up. It's the conditioned nature of the mind. You go to sleep with kind of an annihilation, aspiration, then the hopes of waking up in the morning with kind of enthusiasm, leaping up with alacrity, hardly happens.
Yeah. I notice that at 3 a.m. Puja, you're very enthusiastic with the chant. It's not other ones that enthusiastic chanting.
Well, it's just sort of, it's painful and suffering to just sink into dullness again. So that even if I'm tired, and then it's sort of it's an opportunity to put forth some effort, and then also from that tends to kind of awake and kind of really kind of energizes the system.
Appreciating the fact that you actually did put forth the effort. And having that thought when you go to sleep.
And it's, it's all too familiar habit. But it's one that one has take the opportunity. That's where seeing the danger. It isn't as if it's, really, painful, miserable, horrible. But it's just so you see that pernicious, kind of insidious type of the way the mind loves to drift into the sort of the easiest way out of whatever. And I really appreciate Ajahn Chah's approach to training, because it's not so much being able to control your condition so that you can practice however you like, but being able to put forth the effort when there is some resistance or some kind of a bit of, and it isn't as if you're pushing against yourself all the time, but that ability to confront those edges of where the mind is resisting is really important, because it's a small thing, but it has a huge result.